Dinah had me come in to a Relenj talk at Google. Has anyone seen that video or at that talk? A couple people? Okay. I changed things up a little bit. Hope it's not too repetitive for you. But really, there's not much more to say because a lot of what we're doing here in mobile is the way to do it on mobile. But if you have specific questions, I can go in more depth into different things. I like to step back and see what's going on here. Internally at Facebook, this was kind of drummed into our heads that, you know, release engineering needs to love mobile. Infrastructure needs to love mobile. And typically people who are SRE, Relenj, infrastructure, any of that stuff have a problem with this. And I can tell you personally, I hate mobile. I don't like it at all. Why don't I like mobile? And why don't you like mobile? Because I'm pretty sure you don't like it either. Or if you haven't used, you haven't released the stuff under mobile, you will not like it when you get there. Why I don't like it is, well, we threw away everything that we've done. So if you listen to the great talks from John and best practices from Dinah and all the other folks that from Netflix, and it's kind of a crappy system. And you basically have to go back in time 5 years from where you are now. So all that good stuff you've done with continuous integration, continuous deployment, blah, 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 is thrown away when you get to mobile. And this is really frustrating because on the web side, I'm a well-oiled machine. Most web deployments are well-oiled machines. They are tidy little places where it's a solved problem. Web deployment is not an issue for me any day of the week, any time of the day, period. So my kitchen looks very good, it's very nice, but what happened? Apple and Google showed up, okay? And they made a mess of everything, okay? And they literally got loose in the kitchen and just went, we. And it's not 100% their fault, except on the Apple side, but it's not, you can understand it from a technical point of view and from an operations point of view. You can see how we got into this mess. And it is a mess on mobile. So the question is, okay, what are we gonna do about this? Well, we're gonna look at our release process. Why have a release process on mobile? I'm gonna throw up my stats here just to give you to kind of frame where I'm coming from, and hopefully eventually you'll be coming from the same kind of place. Let's look at iOS. I'm the number one downloaded iOS app. There's 1 billion monthly active people who use mobile. There's that X percent are gonna be on iOS. X percent is gonna, of our daily active people, are gonna be on iOS. There's hundreds of engineers. There are multiple devices. There are many features. And again, there's native and web components. Remember, you're not just the native app. There is a big bunch of web endpoints, APIs, and backend services that need to support a web app of any significance whatsoever. It's the same story on Android. We're the number one non-Google Android app. Again, that has some percentage of those billion monthlies and those 600 million dailies. Multiple devices is a big problem on Android, and I'll show you a picture of that. And again, native and web components. So this is the scale of what we're talking about. When we push this button, and one of my release engineers, Brad's here in the back, he's one of the Android release engineers. When he pushes that button, some percentage of 600 million people are gonna have to go do something, all right? So as release engineers, some of the concerns we have, if I'm deploying web stuff and I have an error, it could either take down the page, there's a fatal on this page, something didn't render right, or something is not quite there. It's pretty easy to go fix this. The effect might not be known, it might be known. You don't know, it's pretty variable about what's gonna happen. A lot of it's very recoverable. On mobile, what's an error look like? Well, you're done. You're out of the application, you're kicked out, you get no grace period, you're bam, the experience is over, and you're back at the main screen. Right? So it's very jarring to the user. It makes them think, your app sucks, right? It's like, every time I try to do this, it does that, and I hate you. And that was generally how we were perceived in the very early days of mobile. A lot of people shaking their head like, yeah, I hate your app. Hopefully nowadays, that's not the case because we've made big improvements, but it was certainly not the most pleasant experience back in the day. So what are our goals here as release engineers? Well, we boiled them down to these two goals for us at Facebook. The first is to maximize the rate of getting stuff into people's hands. Now, Facebook is kind of as well known now. We like to move fast. We like to get stuff out into production as quickly as possible, as frequently as possible. I have a very big web talk where I talk about how we do our web deployments, and I'll talk more about that later in a little bit. But that's kind of our first goal as release engineers. Let things happen, okay? At the same time, we have the other goal of like, okay, we can't ship crap. We have to ship things with high quality and key metrics that keep going, get better, right? And not don't make the user experience any worse. We really can't hurt the people we're trying to serve. So mobile makes this difficult to kind of hit these two goals. And here are some of the things that are fundamentally just broken about mobile. First, is this the accursed red icon on any iOS phone. You pick up the home screen, you look at the app store, and there's going to be a number there. Those are apps waiting to be fixed, waiting for updates. Every user in the world has to push this button as part of their daily life. Okay? Same deal on Android in many cases. This is offensive. This has to go away from the user point of view, period. There shouldn't be time in my life spent pushing that button. From a release engineering standpoint, this is horrible. Would I come to you every time I update Facebook.com and put this up and say, hey, I just did a new push of Facebook. You want it? It wouldn't even be that. It'd be like some little icon in the corner of your Chrome browser, right? Saying, hey, you want to get the update for this page? Bank of America? CNN? United Airlines? No. Do you care when those websites update? No. Are they very functional and have all your data and part of your life? Yes. They're your bank. They're your flights. They're your mail. That's everything. You never stop and say, yeah, give me the new stuff. Right? Why are we doing that on mobile? Worse than that, as release engineers, when you do a push, do you push a button on anything that you produce? You make a package from a few meg to a gigabyte package of your new thing. You push one button, and all your users will get that package, whether it's internal users, external users, anywhere in between. That's not the model by which you release software. Well, on iOS, that's the only way you release software. You build your package, you stage it on their servers at Apple, you push a button, and 100% of your X number, in my case, a couple hundred million people, now get that binary. I have no control about staging it. I have no control of doing a slow rollout. And it's a nightmare. It's not how you release software. On Android, it's a little better for the people who have automatic update turned on and they keep screwing around with where that button is. But if the people who figure it out turn it on, I can do a 5% roll. That's good. I can do a 5% canary with my new package and see if that works before I go to 10%, all right? It's flawed fundamentally because Google won't let me readdress that 5%. I can't roll back. There's no rollback mechanism on the App Store or the Google Play Store. There's no way to pin these 5% so I know if I screwed them, I can get them a new binary. No, they're lost. Once I push to that 5%, I can't get that 5% back to fix them, right? So it's a good first step, but it's like, maybe in John's world, it's a baby step. But I want more from Google to make it less baby, all right? So that's terrifying. Rolling on iOS is especially terrifying because you can't do this. But fundamentally, it all comes down to this. We can't take action on those 1 billion phones that we're all running on until some human being takes action in many cases. Now, iOS 7 got this right in that there is a very frictionless way to turn on auto updates. It's in the settings. It's one push. Update apps automatically. If you have not done that, you should. That's another 10 seconds of your life you're going to get back every day where you're not pushing the button. Android's made it a bit tougher, and it's got a little more criteria about when it can do it, when it can't. I'd like that smoothed out. But the bottom line, being that's only in iOS 7 and up, is that there's a gazillion phones that don't do this. Here's a version graph of what I have running in production on Android. All right, these are the versions sending me telemetry back about what version they're running. What should everyone be running? That little spot there, that's what I just pushed. What is everyone running? All this crap. This is insane. All right? Now, we made a big effort internally. There's ways we can solve this. I could have my app auto update. My app will auto update on Android. It'll have its own channel by which I can make this all work. I turned that on. Google was going to throw me out of the app store if I did that. All right? Because for some reason, I can't do that. So I have to basically push to have people update themselves. So I did that with roosters, what we call roosters, megaphones, roadblocks, and I got in a better shape. Okay, so now when I deploy my I have a almost 50% chance of someone being on the right release. But look at this here. This is crap. That's like, for me, that's tens of millions of people. You know, I might make the joke that my mom is like right there, right? So I can't have this. I can't have these old APIs, these old experiences, privacy bugs, you know, whatever happens to be in these 15 or 20 different releases still out there breathing, right? It's just not a tenable situation. So that's part of what you have to deal with mobile. You have to consider all this, that the fact that every single time you release something, it will live forever, all right? So if you make a horrible mistake, that horrible mistake will live forever. Some idiot made the wrong icon on the iOS release a year ago. I can still walk around the world and see that icon on someone's phone because that build is still on their phone. Right? Let's complicate things a bit more by talking about Android. Android, the testing world and the device world is much more complex. The one good thing about iOS is it's a singular regime. You don't run hardware they don't want you to run, and they obsolete hardware very fast, so the testing is not as bad. But on Android, here are the machines sending telemetry. These are the individual SKUs of mobile phones that are running Facebook on Android. All right? You need to support, if you're going to run Android for your mobile app, you need to support all these things. You got your big blunk, you know, your Samsungs, your HTCs, your Nexus, your Motorolas, and then off into the infinity of the long tail of crappy little Chinese knockoff, you know, Android boxes for the rest of time. Okay? Now, generally, this is not as horrible as it looks, but it, you know, this complicates your life very much. You're clearly not going to test all this stuff. And the implementations, thanks to Google, who seems to, you know, their reference implementations and the and such, make it that most of the stuff just works, but it's not always going to work. I'm not even showing you the matrix of which version of Android they're running. So now do another matrix where it's like Gingerbread, KitKat, ICS, Jelly Bean. What's the stupid name then for the new one? KitKat's the new one? Okay. Not a real fan of the names. But so that's going to complicate things actually even more dramatically than this, because try running your app under Gingerbread versus KitKat, night and day. And meanwhile, Gingerbread is still, anyone know how Gingerbread still is? It's the oldest one that's still supported, I think, after Froyo. What, still like 40%, 50% of phones is Gingerbread? Some Google people should know that. But it's a scary number. All right, so those are the realities of kind of what we're dealing with here. And those are the big ones for me as a release engineer that you'll have to deal with as well. Let's talk about organizationally. How did we deal with shipping mobile from coming from like a package software or a web-centric kind of release world? Well, the first thing was we had to fix the actual structure of the company. And this is what you're going to do if you come from a web world and all of a sudden mobile's a part of your life. You're going to have this structure where you have all your product experts kind of doing the normal thing they do, and then mobile comes along and you're like, oh, we got iOS guys, we got Android guys, just make them do it, all right? And you're just going to throw the photo stuff or messaging or whatever you're going to do, they just like port it over to that platform. That makes a really crappy mobile experience. And in our first mobile deployments, our first mobile apps 3, 4, 5 years ago, that's kind of what it was. It was kind of just a crappy port of functionality that came from the product experts. What we did about a couple years ago is we bit the bullet and we now made everyone just, you know, they're not platform experts, everyone is a product expert. So when you come out of, you get hired, you don't get hired into the iOS team, you get hired into the photos team or the messages team or the events team, and you worry about events. And maybe you know iOS, so you're gonna worry about events on iOS, right? Not the other way around. So this is actually painful to do, and it looks kind of obvious to us now. But to get an organization into this kind of structure is not, you know, some toes were stepped on, some people actually left. But in the long run, we're much happier because of this. The proof is in the pudding, and here's a graph of like the number of developers that are checking into the mobile code base after we made that change. So once that change was made and people reoriented, now you actually have actual, you know, actual product development happening on mobile, indicated by the big increase of the number of people working on the mobile code base. So now the product experts are getting in there and doing things much more quickly and much more with much more impact. We are big fans of a date-based release system for mobile. All right, we can't do continuous deployment. We can't do continuous delivery. We can't do continuous deployment on mobile. So that's the best solution. What are you going to do instead? Well, you're going to do this crappy date-based system. Now, I've said this a million times, and you know this for a fact. John alluded to it in his talk. No software project has ever shipped on its date. Software engineers live in a different space-time continuum than real time. Okay, So it's like building contractors. Take me 2 days. You know, in real time, that's like 6 days, right? So we're not happy with this, but this is what we have to do for mobile. So the fixed date release process is what we do. What are the implications of this? It's been written before, but when you ship stuff, you have these three things you're worried about: the features, the quality, and the schedule. When you're under a date-based restraint, something's got to give. Features. Features go out. You worry about quality, and you worry about the schedule. You're going to hit your day, and your the quality and your metrics are going to be where they need to be. All right. And a lot of this is where you're going to have your tension, because you just threw out the bread and butter, the features. How do you manage that? How do you justify it? Well, you get people in the mindset that you ship on time. You don't miss that date, okay? And it's hard to do, but it has some advantages. You can pitch it like this. You can say, listen, if your stuff is in, you're guaranteed to get out on that day. If you have a press release, if you have some sort of announcement, if you have a reason to be out on that day, I can tell you, you will be out on that day. I'm not going to stop or reset or wait for one more change, because we're going, right? It's a train system. The train's leaving. Don't worry about it. You're going to get out. So that's always a good sell. You have to have the mentality that whatever you're doing, you're not making anything worse. So the quality bar can't move. And very quickly, especially if you come from a place where you're having quality issues, it's easy to get this signed off on from senior management and whatnot. Like, listen, let's not go back to the dark days. Every release will make the metrics go better. And this is the big one. This is my favorite one. And this is the hammer that you can use to quell any little riot that's rising up around you. There's always the next one, and you know when it is. So I just threw your feature out, but I can tell you exactly when the next release is, exactly how to get into it, what you have to do to make it work. You know what's happening. You're not in the dark. You don't have to panic. You know exactly when the next thing's going to happen. This should relieve all that tension between the PMs and the development and the CXO or whoever who want to get shit done, and you who want to have the release process and have a common, a normal way to get things out in a low-risk way. All right. Now, the question is, how long is that time? And we'll talk about that. And again, a fundamental principle here is that if something breaks or isn't ready or you have any qualms about what's going out, just take it out. All right. Don't try to fix forward. You can do that a little bit in the beginning as you kind of get this release stabilized, depending on how much time you have. You'll take some fix forward things. But after you take four things from somebody and you're like a week into the process and they come to you like, it's still broken, like, oh, I just got two more changes. Just take these two more and it'll be better. Just stop. Now, you can set that bar wherever you want, but internally, just have some sort of subjective line, which if someone crosses, you're like, you know what? You're done. We'll just revert your stuff, turn off the feature flag, whatever it takes. Just go on the next one. Stop bothering me, all right? So keep that in mind. So let's talk about the mechanics here of how to actually manage the code itself. This is the world-famous, you know, desktop web, Facebook.com release process, and I've talked about this at length. This system works great. It works by itself. We can't do true continuous deployment because we have thousands of changes. We have hundreds of changes a day, about 5,000 to 6,000 changes a week going into Facebook.com and all of that. So I can't really continuously deploy that. It's too terrifying. But what I can do is I take a week's worth of development, I cut a simple release branch. That release branch is what goes out to the public. You know, I stabilize it for about a day and a half, and I push it live. The weekly push, which for us is on Tuesday. It's funny how Tuesday tends to be the thing that we always use. That's probably bad. We should stagger ourselves, maybe talk a little later. Like, hey, Netflix, you do Wednesday. I got Tuesday. Microsoft can do Monday. So on Tuesday, we make that big release push. That's like 4,000, 5,000 changes that went in during the week. Okay. Every day after that, I cherry pick specific changes, and I push twice a day at 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. Pacific time. That's between 30 to 300 changes on every daily push. That's the cadence of Facebook.com. Again, no stress on things. If things don't get out today at the 8 o'clock push, I just wait till the 1 o'clock push. If I don't get it in the 1 o'clock push, I get the next day at 8 o'clock. There's no stress about getting stuff out to Facebook.com. You know there's a train leaving, like, constantly. All right? No big deal. All right, let's overlay the mobile world. So mobile is 4 weeks for us. We have a four-week development and deployment process. So it's very similar, right? I cut a simple release branch. Actually, that's on a Thursday, so okay, I've changed days. And I have 3.5 weeks of me trying to get that working, and I cherry pick things to make this work given the criteria, and I'll kind of go over the criteria again by how we decide what to cherry pick. I soak for a little bit of time to say, okay, does everything still work? Don't touch it for 2 days, see if it gathers state, if things leak, what happens, and then we release it on the four-week Thursday following, okay, Thursday. That was awesome, but 4 weeks is a long time. Think of the worst case scenario for the poor guy trying to do a product iteration, because you iterate, right? You don't just make a product like, oh, done, that's good, let's go on to the next thing. No, you kind of try a couple different things, and you might have to change it. The worst case, though, is some poor guy will make a change on master. It finally gets into the release branch. It gets put out. That's like 6 weeks, depending on where that first check-in was, right? Now he gets data, and after it's in production for a little while, he says, oh, yeah, there's some changes I want to make. He goes back into master, makes the changes, the next branch picks it up, and it goes out again. That's like 3 months worth of waiting around to get one iteration on mobile, okay? That stinks, and that's a legitimate complaint they had against our process here. It's like, listen, this is the delta between me making my fix here and me seeing the iteration of that way down here all this time for, you know, these 12 weeks or whatever is not making me happy. And we said, you are exactly right. You can have up more than 3 months to iterate on a product cycle. So I'm pleased to announce here, worldwide exclusive, we are now going to a 2-week release cycle on Android. That cycle ended yesterday. Anyone who has an Android phone today will get an update notification if they don't have auto update turned on, and you are getting the first build of our 2-week cycle, which launched yesterday, all right, to 5%. We do a 5%, 10% roll on Android. That just happened. So now I have 2 weeks of development, I make the branch, 2 weeks of cherry picks, week and a half of landing them, and I release. That is awesome. 2 weeks is good. Still not fast enough. I want to get to 1 week, maybe by the end of the year on Android. All right. Now the way I can do this, and why am I doing it on Android, is because I have the alpha and beta programs, right? The beta program on Android is great. What it means is I can ship those builds every single night to a number of volunteers on the beta program. How many people do I have in the beta program? It's between 2 to 3 million people, all right, sitting, waiting for, they have automatic update turned on, obviously. So they get automatically every night, they get a new beta build. I get data from that, I get dashboards dedicated to beta. I can see exactly night over night what their crash rate is, any logging that gets generated, all the core metrics, and any complaints they have come back as well. That works so well that we also have an alpha program. Alpha ships every night. What is alpha? It's whatever's checked into master. So again, wrap your head around the fact that I am shipping master to about 300,000 people every night. If you're an Android developer at Facebook, you write code, you check it into master, it's going to 300,000 people that night, which again is awesome and terrifying. So we have some things in place to try not to blow ourselves out of the water, but that's what's happening. And as a release engineer, you want that. And as we've talked about, you know, John and Daniel, both Daniels, and talked about like why you want those canaries, why you want that data as fast as possible. So how do we make this 2-week thing work? And what's this criteria by which we cherry pick stuff into that release branch? How do you decide what to do there? It's not automated. I mean, a lot of it's automated, but actually a human's going to make that decision. I'll show you why. That's kind of the secret sauce that happens during that 2-week, and on iOS it's still 4 weeks, but during that process, this is what we think about. We talked about no adding features, right? So if something wasn't in by the time the branch was cut, in theory, should not go in. You can't cherry pick a big feature, all right? Now again, you have to determine your own internal fortitude about where you want to make that line cut. If it's a feature, not a feature, is it big enough, not big enough? I'll let you figure that out from your experience of getting burned or not burned, depending on the change and who did it. But fundamentally, why we're doing this, there's a lot of reasons you can think of. Some of the obvious ones here is like, you know, we lose all our testing time because it goes right from basically right into the release candidate. All that time we take to stabilize, all the testing time. And finally, if it didn't make the cut, we're gonna consider it just wasn't ready to go. All right. Remember that done isn't just native code. There is a ton of stuff that needs to be considered in the mobile space before something lands to go out the door. Design is a big deal. I mean, the mobile screen is as big as a couple thumbs together, right? It's tiny. Every little pixel on every mobile app that you use, believe me, has been thought about and debated. Every color, every shape, every position, every use of the crappy real estate that they give us to work with has been analyzed. If you make a late change, you perturb that whole ecosystem because it didn't kind of have time to sit in master, get looked at, whatever. You're basically checking into master, requesting a cherry pick, getting in the release branch, T minus X to launch, depending on if it's a 2-week process, where you are in that. And a bunch of other stuff, like I said, the server side needs to come up. Privacy and legal review, there are extra requirements that we're all under. We're under big scrutiny, but I guarantee you, if you launch any mobile app, you as well will be under scrutiny under privacy and legal review because there's a bunch of laws outside the US that are very hard to comply with that you need to worry about on mobile. Again, stuff that comes in late puts that at risk because it wasn't able to be looked at by the privacy legal review team or whatever. So a lot of reasons why you don't want to do that. So how do I manage this? It's basically I have to, my team approves every cherry pick. And this is where John was talking about, where I forget what he called it, but basically we have program managers, release managers, what do we call them, or TPMs, technical project managers or technical program managers. And so every time someone wants to get into the release branch with a cherry pick, we use Fabricator, which is our diff tool. But when a diff is accepted into master, this little link shows up and it says, hey, make a request to the cherry pick tool. It's called Relief. It's open source, part of Fabricator. If they click that, their change gets put on this page. This is an Android release. There's about 30, 40, 50 of these cherry pick requests up on a given day, all right? And we can see why they're asking for this change. We can see what the commit message was. And I've talked about this, but you know, I have these metrics here. This size thing tells me how big the diff was, how many files were added or changed. You can add that easily. The churn is how much discussion there was in the diff itself. Here's my diff. This diff sucks. No, you suck. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. As that, you know, as that gets bigger, you know, as that discussion goes, this will get bigger. So my release engineers have an idea of like if these bars are big, you kind of want to make put more scrutiny on this change. And we do have the world famous push karma. Everyone heard about push karma? So I keep a record of basically how well engineers do when it comes to getting stuff out the door. You can only see your own push karma. You can't see anyone else's. And everyone has 4 stars when they start at Facebook. If something happens and I take this cherry pick and this blows me out of the water in one way or another, or you just generally piss me off, you get this, okay? And when we click this, you lose 0.5 star. A window pops up. We type up what happened, how we can improve. I click submit. It goes to me, goes to you, goes to your manager, and it goes to our work.com performance review tool. So it's kind of officially stamped. All right. It's very much a private shaming, not a public shaming. You don't want to do public shaming. I'm okay with private shaming. But it's there to help manage risk. And when I sit in a room full of developers, all I see is risk. And it used to be with a 300-person company when I started, I could just look in the room and go like, risk, 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 you know? And I could see the stars above all your heads, right? But now there's like 2,000, 2,500 developers at Facebook. I can't keep them all in mind. We wrote this system. You're gonna do it anyway. Don't tell anyone that, you know, if someone will tell you, oh, you can't do that, bullshit. You can do it. You do it in your head, guaranteed. They can't keep you from doing it. And you need to do it, all right? And it's not a punishment thing. No one's ever gotten fired because they had 2 stars. But when someone has 2 stars, we just won't take their stuff. We need to figure out what's going on. And we can have a discussion, and we can improve our operational awareness because we're all DevOps. And we have to have the ops part with the dev part. And if our ops part is lacking, which that's fine. None of us are all, you know, we're not all born with operational awareness. We at least have an indicator like, okay, here's where we need to put some effort to help this person get their operational awareness up, right? So I know it's a little controversial, but you should totally do something like that because you're doing it anyway. And finally, you got to be kind of chicken on the release branch. You're risk averse. You're basically, you're going to have, when you look at a diff or cherry pick, you're going to have a whole set of pluses and minuses of like, am I going to take this change as a release engineer? And the pluses are like, okay, it's a stability fix. It's got the automated tests ran. It was tested in master. Another app is using it, or other code's being used somewhere else. The negatives are, like I said, design, logging changes, new features, string changes. Internationalization is a big deal for us. You can't change strings. We're in every language on earth. It takes time to make that string change. And like I think it was John or someone said, like you can't, don't ignore that internationalization part and start skewing your app. Yeah, it was John. For don't skew your app on languages. So don't do that. and so forth. And finally, the absolute rule, this is my quote from Ronin with Robert De Niro, if there is any doubt, there is no doubt. If you as a release engineer do not feel comfortable with stuff going out, some change, some decision, back it out, turn it off, just get out of danger, all right? Don't play on that edge. Don't waste your time. All right, I'm going to quickly go, I kind of broke this talk into kind of this culture thing and this tool thing. I'm going to blast through the tools because we all have our tools. A lot of these are open sourced. I think you know what these tools do. But it's the culture part I wanted to spend the most amount of time on, because that's kind of what you as, you know, release engineers in your organizations need to work towards, because the tools will come one way or another. Fundamentally, I want my tools to do, one of the things I want them to do is stabilize trunk. If trunk is in better shape, when I make my release branch, that's how I can get down to a very short release cycle on mobile, because my master is good. The top of trunk is good. So for me, the first big thing we did was get back continuous integration, which we lost when we went to mobile. Sucked. So I have three levels of stuff I do for every single check-in. I have my build level with our Buck system, which is open sourced, B-U-C-K, and BuildBot. So we build, we're a monolithic tree like Google, okay? The iOS app and the Android app, the trees for that are Facebook, Instagram, Messenger, Pages Manager, all those live commingled, okay? So when you make a change to Facebook for Android, I'm gonna build everything, all the apps, even if you didn't touch it, because there might be a cross dependency you didn't check and it'll break the build for Instagram, okay? While that's going, I'm going to run a lint and static analysis test on your code. That I can do easily. I can run a regex looking for API calls or other coding convention things that we don't want. We can use Clang for memory leaks, dead code, unused variables, stuff like that. Android and iOS have their own little find bugs and Android linters and stuff like that. Run as much of that crap as you can. There's more stuff coming out every day for that. It's all free. Just run it. While that's going on, run your tests. And we use OCUnit, Snapshot, JUnit, RoboElectric, WebDriver, I don't care. There's stuff out there. Use it. Run it all the time. Run as many as you can. All right? Just basically, this is a crude approach. It's the sledgehammer approach. But this is what you need right now for mobile. It's going to get better in the future. But right now, just use a sledgehammer. Build everything, run everything, lint everything. So I have this stack that I run every time. When do I run it? I run it every step of the way. That whole stack will run up to 5 times or more for every commit. Not just when it gets committed. It's going to get run when the guy's thinking about doing the diff. I want to, like, if I'm going to go through this, before I create my diff, I just want to make sure I've done it okay myself. So I'll run it while I'm working on my code. Then I'll run the whole stack mandatory. When the diff is created, the tool will run that whole stack. If I update the diff, it's going to run that stack again because it's new code now. You've changed it since the last time I ran it. There's a landing queue, because when this is coming in so fast into Git, which we're stuck using Git for these projects, stuff is coming in so fast, somebody needs to do the rebase to bring up that code. We'll do it for you. And when we do, we've effectively changed the source base again. Even if we didn't change your code, the code around you changed. We'll run the whole stack again. And finally, when you commit, we'll run it again. This is excessive. I might be killing it because I have the resources. I have basically infinite compute and storage resources. Don't tell my boss I said that. And Google's the same way. You can basically consider that you have infinite resources. Machine resources should not be the thing limiting you from doing these things. All right? Machines are so cheap. Virtual machines, real machines, Amazon Web Services, whatever you want to use, get the boxes in place. Not a big deal these days. It's kind of pathetic if you can't ensure your safety because you can't get boxes to run this stuff. All right, so I'll make the push for that. So this asynchronous build and test system that runs, it's pretty synchronous. I mean, obviously, it's an asynchronous process because we can't get it all done in the time it takes. But when you commit, you know, it's in the order of minutes to get all that data back. When the diff is created, as the diff goes out, all these boxes, which represent the runs of all those things I described, will turn green. So when the reviewer looks at your diff, they're going to see a big stack of green boxes that say, yeah, I ran all those things Chuck talked about. And if any of them are red, the reviewer goes, hey, that's red. Why don't you go fix that before I look at it? Right? And those will pop in as, like, the reviewer is going to get your diff immediately, right? But as these things succeed, they're going to pop in so the reviewer will see the progress of all that. And by the way, and we talked about this, those frickin' Macs, right? So we had to build our own rack, invent a rack, some way to rack minis, and I need about 40 or 50 of those for my uses to fill out to do enough builds to get this done. Not a problem with Android because I run it on my Linux box. Guess how many builds I do a day of Android? So I do between 30 to 40,000 builds a day on Android. Because to fill out all those boxes I showed you, right? That's building every product five times for every commit. That's 30,000 builds, right? Don't be afraid by that. You know, if I can do it, I'm not that bright. So I know you can do it, right? It's just a matter of just throwing resources at it. Not there on Mac yet, on OS X. I'll show you a familiar picture here. Shrubbery, we call it. Looks familiar. Kind of looks like Tinderbox. But anyway, the point this being, you need that Tinderbox-style dashboard that shows the reviewer and shows the release engineer exactly when things go wrong. This test failed on this commit. There's no mystery, okay? And this is our interface for every build. We'll show you like what it built, what passed, what failed. Very easy to figure out exactly when things go wrong. Dogfooding. I obviously talked about this. There were big proponents of dogfooding. We're very kind of draconian in Facebook about dogfooding. You cannot escape being a dogfooder at Facebook. I don't care if you're from marketing exec down to Zuck to whoever. You will not run the production versions of the apps, period. Okay? If you use Facebook.com, you don't use Facebook.com. I always redirect you to something else. If you download the Facebook for Android from Google Play, we will kick you out and run the RC. We'll download and install the release candidate. If you try to run iOS, this was hard to do because iOS doesn't like you know, give you the hooks to do this. But if you try to run the App Store version of iOS, we'll actually see you're an employee, stop, and we'll tell you to go download the release candidate from our secure dog food page. Okay? People don't like that. We got a lot of flack, but tough. It's a company thing that like I want to give you pain before a billion people see anything bad from us, and I think it's a pretty easy sell to the C-level people. The test console, we talked about the automated testing and Netflix. Daniel showed some things that his team's doing. Very similar here. You can see the test runs. If you see something red, just click on it. You can see the test that failed. You can click on it again. You can see the history of when it failed. So we had to add all these things, and Daniel was mentioning, it's like a lot of noise that people get because of like tests have failed and the developer gets pinged and oh, now it works, it's a flaky test or whatever, the database was down or something happened. So you want to remove that from the developer. They hate that noise and it makes them ignore this stuff. So we wrote a test failure bot. And the bot will go and examine the quality of the tests. It will down karma tests. So if a test is flaky or is not happy, it will lose its karma until the test is eventually thrown out. The test bot will also try to auto-assign test failures to the person it thinks should best own it. It will also close tests that were working, not working, then working again. So why do you have a task open against you for a failed test now that it's working? So it'll auto-close it, okay? So these kind of automation things are what you want to think, like how can I reduce the load of noise on the developer? With all this, we can still have master break. And again, we've talked about this, John talked about it. In Mozilla, they called it the sheriff. We call it the on-call. I don't care who you call it. This is why they're there. They are the first line of defense. They're the person you go to say like, hey, something doesn't work. Okay, I'll fix it. And they have the power to revert. They'll go to the dashboard. They'll see at what point something broke. They'll see the diff. They'll try to find Jordan who broke this. If they can't find Jordan, just revert it. There's a special tag that you can put in your commit message to say, hey, I'm a sheriff and this is a build break. Just tag it with that in the commit message and you kind of lob that change over all those tests and you land it right into master. Okay, so we can get the tree back on its feet immediately. These sheriffs and these on-calls are also what we use for like engineering expertise during the release. For the week that they're the on-call, they are the person that we go to when we have a cherry pick that we, you know, we're not experts in mobile as much as we want to be. And I look at a cherry pick, I'm like, man, this looks pretty hairy. Let's get the engineering on-call for the engineering release on-call, have them look at it. So that person, that engineer is now part of your team. They're part of the gang. They're part of the release team. This release, this actually, they're on a two-week cycle, on or two-week or four-week cycle, depending on which iOS or Android. For those 4 weeks or those 2 weeks, we're going to go to them constantly. They're responsible for this release. By the time that time comes, they're going to be like more like a release engineer than they want to admit, because they're like, oh man, I'm really freaked out. We're going to launch this thing and I'm responsible, right? So they gain a big appreciation for what you do and how you do it. And I've had a sloppy developer who actually has 2 stars to his name become an engineering release pusher. And you know, now he has improved himself because we put him in this role of the other side of the gun to say like, okay, this is what it's like taking all your crappy changes. So it gave him a whole new appreciation for like, okay, this is important, and it improved him on both sides of the equation. All right, so fundamentally, mobile changed everything for us. It changed how we develop, it changed how we ship, it changed how we wrote code, but that culture that we had of like shipping fast, DevOps, continuous improvement, that we held on to. And we just made mobile bend to our will in order to do this. And I can say confidently, Facebook is a mobile company. We have dozens of mobile apps, more coming out every day. You saw Slingshot was launched yesterday. So more stuff is going to be coming out. We're going to fix this mobile problem. Facebook's a little bit ahead of things because of our scale and the number of users we have. But I need your support as well on getting, you know, Apple and Google to pay attention to these things that we're complaining about, like auto update, like the frickin' stores. We need APIs to the Play Store. We need APIs to the App Store. I mean, we have 12 APKs. For every one of these things, there's 12 packages that have to be uploaded by hand, clicking some dopey web interface one at a time, with the release notes, with the screenshots. It sucks. We wrote a WebDriver script that does the clicks for us. That's embarrassing, okay? And I know Google's making progress here, but Apple, I was talking to their VP, whoever, and I'm like going through my list of demands, and I got to like, hey, I need an API for the store. Like, AP what? Like, so I mean, it's gonna be a while. The other thing I need desperately need from Apple is a beta program. The reason I'm so fast on Android is that beta program. Anybody here at the Worldwide Developer Conference, what did they announce? A beta program. How many people can you have in the beta program? 1,000. That's embarrassing. I'm not even angry anymore. I'm just embarrassed that that's a number, right? I have 3 million people in my beta. I just want 1% of my user base. How about that? Instead of a hard number, give me 1%, okay? 1% of 300 million would be fine for me. That, you know, their thinking is just not at the scale that it needs to be. So again, if you, with your help, I think we can get some traction for getting this mobile ecosystem changed to help us provide better apps, better user experience, and a better environment for us. Now, contact information, we're building a great team at Facebook. If you have ideas on mobile, how to make the system better, please talk to me. Please consider, you know, joining up forces and considering to work on mobile with me at Facebook. It's an exciting kind of time. So I'll end there. Thank you. Take any questions people have.
I like you, dislike building mobile applications, and I think in the iOS space, I can safely say I hate it with the red hot passion of 10,000 suns. And I guess my question for you, since you obviously have more contact with these folks than me, is Apple in any way starting to get it? I mean, do they not understand that, you know, we need to be able to virtualize a Mac if you're going to force us to build it on a Mac? We need to be able to have rack-mounted servers. We need to be, you know, just simple stuff like that. And
I'm taping this, right?
Yeah, I mean, are you getting any feedback from them that there's any movement in that direction?
They clearly want to try. It's hard to tell because Apple doesn't really open up much about things. I can't say much at this point. I don't know. I mean, they're very clearly optimized for a certain type of app and a certain size, and that's their sweet spot. the tools are good, the Xcode and all that are good, but like you say, I need to run it on a fleet of 6,000-7,000 machines to do 30,000 builds of that, you know, a day. So I don't think they're thinking quite that scale yet.
It's not quite the Apple solution, but there are a couple of companies out there now making 1U rack chassis. So you don't need to do, we were doing it in zip ties and stuff at first, but they now make custom 1U racks shelving that fit four Mac Minis.
Right.
So that's a aftermarket addition, if you like.
Yeah,
there's a couple
yeah.
of companies actually do hosted Mac Minis.
Exactly.
As a Cola. Now, it's not cheap, but these are short-term work.
Yeah, the point being, like, the ecosystem is going to solve this problem with them or without them.
Yeah.
And sometimes we solve the problem, and they don't like the way we solve the problem, and we have to unsolve the problem. We've had two or three examples of that. So it's a little bit two steps forward, one step back, but we're getting there. I think, you know, the last WWDC, and at least they're paying attention with test flight and beta program. If I can get them to add two more zeros, three more zeros to that number in the beta program, that would be a good thing. So it is progress. The question is, when I build on the Mac Minis, do I use virtualization? Generally, no. It's just one-to-one. What we have done is we've written a bunch of tools to, we can do like the crash report. We wrote a tool, A2SL, that does the crash stack reporting that runs on Linux. We ported as much as we can port to Linux further, so we can run them just in mass for the reporting tools and the crash analysis. We've open sourced a couple of those. XC tool is the big one that we did. That lets you run basically X tool from the command line in a nice way with pretty output and all that, so we can do builds and stuff, you know, things along those lines. So those are the kind of things that we're solving those problems with. We have the resources to solve those, and we open source anything. I'll make you this promise: anything I do manage to figure out on iOS, I will open. You know, we'll try to open source it as best we can. Because I don't want to, you know, I don't want you guys to suffer any more than we do. So we've already open sourced two big things. We'll keep doing that.
So you mentioned that when you're date driven, you're able to pull out features, whole features, when they're not quite ready. So wondering if you can talk a little bit about the techniques you use, because generally features like that, I imagine, span dozens, if not more.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and there's a couple of ways to do it. One way, the best way, and this is a big cultural thing at Facebook, is our feature flag system is called Gatekeeper. And Gatekeeper works on web, works on mobile. So if you develop a new feature, you generally hide it behind a gatekeeper. So if I say, your feature sucks, it's nowhere near ready, we need to get it out, you turn off that gatekeeper for this release. That's the easiest way. If that doesn't work, the cherry pick system I showed, the Relief, actually has a revert button. So if I did cherry pick stuff, and I say, like, all right, enough, I'm un-cherry picking everything, I have a button. Now it's up to the whims of Git or Mercurial to figure out if I can actually do a safe revert, but 90% of the time it works. Worst case is somebody's got to go in and handcraft in the release branch, handcraft some sort of revert to get that code out, and that's the worst case. But generally that doesn't happen, because we'll pull the plug way before it gets too complex. Or if it's that complex, it will have a gatekeeper. All right, I'll be around. Any other questions, please feel free to ask. Thank you.